you, Harry, for previewing part of my speech. If you ever get a chance to sit with Harry, do get him to explain the economics of orange juice to you. He did that to me in Montana, I think, in 1992, and I was able to write 10 years later, write a great piece in the London Daily Telegraph as a result. It's a wonderful story he tells about orange juice. I'm delighted to be here. I've long admired Reason. I recall the excitement back in the 1970s in London when each issue of Reason would land in the UK. And in particular, Harry, I recall buying a number of copies of Cutting Back City Hall by Bob Poole. And I'd like to read to you from my new book on Margaret Thatcher what happened. And this is, where's Manny? Manny loves this story. He sent me a very excited email about this story. The intellectual case for contracting out came from an American MIT-trained engineer turned policy wonk, Bob Poole, head of the Reason Foundation in Santa Barbara, and author of a little book called Cutting Back City Hall. In this book, he explained how all you needed to run a city was a CEO, a lawyer to review contracts, and a secretary. Everything, literally everything, could be outsourced, and he littered his book with examples and figures. For everything a city might want to do, Poole found examples of private provision, usually at half the cost, sometimes at one-third. The author, that's me, imported and sold quantities of the book, including one to Westminster City Councilman Michael Forsyth. Forsyth proceeded to write three short monographs on contracting out, two for the Conservative Political Centre and one for the newly formed Adam Smith Institute. To this day, the Adam Smith Institute, 30 years later, says that this pamphlet by Forsyth, copying Poole, was its best seller of all time, selling over 20,000 copies. To translate that into American, that would be about 100,000 in this. These monographs translated Poole's work into an English context, and led by Westminster City Council, contracting out spread like a contagious disease throughout the country. And I end up saying that as a result of all of this, the annual value of such contracts awarded now in England, in the United Kingdom, 30 years later, is $56 billion. That's quite a story, Bob. That's probably saving us something like $20 or $30 billion of taxpayers' money. I mean, I don't know why the Queen hasn't knighted you. that's every year. And also, of course, the private contractors do a much, much, much better job. So we have to remember that. I want to do five things. I want to paint a picture of Lady Thatcher's ascent from modest origins to becoming Prime Minister. I want to describe the state of the UK in 1979, 30 years ago when she won. I want to list her successes. Fourthly, I want to draw 10 lessons from those successes. And fifthly, I want to close by listing what a modern Lady Thatcher would have to do to equal her record. I've been with her twice recently, once for cocktails and once for dinner. She's had minor strokes and hasn't spoken in public, I think, since the autumn of 2002, fall of 2002. But she complains that I don't invite her to things often enough. And she asked me to give you her very best wishes. First, her ascent. She was born in 1926 in a small market town called Grantham in Lincolnshire on the eastern side of the United Kingdom. Self-employment is written all over her family tree for at least four generations. She was the second daughter of a man called Alf Roberts, who ran the grocer's shop, a small grocer's shop. He eventually had two shops, in fact, in Grantham. Alf was a pillar of the local community. He held every kind of civic post. He was a councilman, an alderman, the mayor. During the war, he was an air raid precaution warden. You name a civic post, he held it. He'd left school at age 12, but was known in Grantham as the most learned man in town. There was no bath in the house. There was no running hot water, no television, of course, and, in fact, no wireless, no radio. But there were dozens of books borrowed from the local public library. An adult conversation at breakfast, lunch, and day around the meal table was the order of the day. A local movie house opened Margaret's eyes to a wider world, and one of her early favourites was it Mr. Smith? Mr. Smith Goes to Washington with Jimmy Stewart. And she also fell in love with the works of Walt Whitman, introduced to her by her dad, who was clearly a classical liberal. Now, Lincolnshire is very flat, and it's on the east coast, and it's close to, it's the closest bit of England to Germany. And during the war, the United States Air Force came in and quickly laid out runways and built air force bases. But this led to a problem for her father, because sometimes the United States Air Force personnel would have time off, say on a Sunday, and the Sabbath was very important then, and the parks were closed and the movie house was closed. So the young Margaret heard her father struggling with these kinds of issues. You know, would he open the park so they could throw around a football, or would he open the movie house? In the end, they opened the movie house on the grounds that wouldn't disturb the Sabbath so much as a lot of young American men chucking a football around. She walked to school, back for lunch, and then back for the afternoon, and back in the evening, about a mile each way, and she walked by its dole queues of the late 30s, by bomb damage in the early 40s, because there was a munitions factory down the road that the Germans would target. She skipped a year in school and aimed to study chemistry at Oxford, which was quite a reach. It was a huge reach. In fact, Oxford still insisted on Latin in those days, and of course there wasn't a Latin teacher at the girls' school, because, you know, girls wouldn't go to Oxford, of course. I mean, it's unthinkable from a small market town. So her dad dipped into his savings and got a Latin tutor, the Latin teacher from the boys' school, and she did 7 years of Latin in 6 months, but nevertheless failed and was coming back to school for a final year when somebody dropped out and she got a telegram, and she went off to Oxford aged 17. She was there for 4 years. She volunteered to bus table at a local United States Air Force base near Oxford 2 nights a week. The union, the famous Oxford Union, was closed to women in those days. She was only allowed up in the very top to observe. So she threw herself, instead of into the debating union, into the Oxford University Conservative Association, becoming the second ever lady chairman of that organisation. The first, a couple of years earlier, had a dad who was one of Winston Churchill's cabinet ministers. So she had a kind of an inside track. So she was the first lady to head up AUCA, Oxford University Conservative Association, without inside connections. On graduating, she got a job in industry as a chemist. She got adopted for a safe socialist seat of Dartford and Kent in the Conservative interest, and fought the 50 and 51 general elections. She met a local businessman, Dennis, married him, bore twins, Mark and Carol, decided to switch from chemistry to the law, and trained as a barrister. However, the 50s were for her a huge struggle to get a safe seat, and it was always she always came second, and it was always the women who opposed her. It was always the woman on the selection committee who said, how could you possibly do this job with two young children? And her argument that her husband was pretty well healed, and she had a couple of nannies, and you know, she was looking after the family quite well as a barrister, and she thought she could certainly do it as an MP, fell on deaf ears until she narrowly won Finchley in North London and got into Parliament in 1959, holding Finchley until 1992, when, having stepped down as Prime Minister, of course, she went up to the House of Lords. From 59 onwards, being female probably helped her. It certainly helped her get early preferment, and when she became leader of the Conservative Party, it made her sort of quite stand out. So second, what was the state of the UK when she won? Well, the winter of 79 was called the winter of discontent, as in William Shakespeare's opening line of Richard III, "Now is the winter of our discontent." We'd had double-digit inflation for 6 years, with pickets all over the place. There was 1 million people laid off because of industrial action. Ambulances were not responding to 911 calls. There were mountains of trash. The trash collectors were on strike. This was before Bob had privatised them all. And there was... you go to places... You come to London, you go to places like Leicester Square and Trafalgar Square. They were just a sea of trash, 20, 30 feet high, because the trash collectors were on strike. The grave diggers were on strike. And coffins with bodies inside them were piled up in disused factories. And local health officials were openly worrying about health risks and thinking of having mass burials at sea. There were food shortages. Hospital union leaders were deciding who should be admitted to hospital and who not. And if folk died, so be it, as one of them said. Trolleys of food to old people's homes were smashed up. And British Rail was forced to issue the shortest press release in history. It read, "There aren't no trains today." Of course, she was the fourth ever elected lady leader, following Mrs. Bandaranaike in 1960 in Sri Lanka, Mrs. Indira Gandhi in 64 in India, and Golda Meir in 69 in Israel. But she was the first in the West. Interestingly enough, Indira Gandhi had attended the same college at Oxford as Margaret did, Somerville College. But she inherited an economy that was 19th out of 22 in the OECD ranking. The French ambassador said our economy was suffering from dégringolade, which is French for falling down sickness. You knew that, didn't you? The West German ambassador, this was before the unification, compared the British economy to that of East Germany. And it was quite commonly said that that Germany and Japan were lucky that they had been bombed and had been forced to replace their capital with new capital. And we'd been unlucky that we hadn't been bombed enough. To which Hayek said, I don't think the solution to our economic problems is to destroy all our capital. So, third, what did she do? Let me summarise in nine sentences her 11 and a half years of hard work. She took on the whole trade union movement and brought it back under the rule of law and took the leadership of the unions away from the extremists and gave the leadership back to the members. She transformed through endless lectures and homilies the nation's view of the benefits of a market economy. She privatised the commanding heights of the economy, thus transforming their fortunes and starting a worldwide movement. I think she privatised something like 40 major industries, and I wrote about this in Reason, I think, in 1983, an article called Margaret Goes to Market, when this was just all starting. She taught us the need for monetary continence if we wish to enjoy low inflation. She enfranchised millions of local authority serfs through giving them their right to buy their own unit of public housing. She made Brits walk tall again through a firm, principled, robust approach to foreign relations. She started the process which has now led to peace in Northern Ireland. She helped Ronald Reagan to tear down that wall without a shot and destroy the evil empire. And she ensured that all future British governments have to be much friendlier to laissez-faire capitalism than had been the case prior to 1979. What were the results? She was in power for 11 years, but the 7 years of John Major, I don't think there wasn't such a thing as majorism. It was just sort of like lukewarm Thatcherism and a bit of retreating. So I count the Thatcher era really as 18 years later. 18 years later, we jumped from 19th to 2nd on the OECD ladder. We'd become a nation of entrepreneurs with self-employment doubling from 7% to 14% of the workforce. Nigel Lawson, Chancellor of the Exchequer, was in his memoirs to note that when she came to power in 1979, we didn't have a venture capital industry in the UK, but 6 years later, our venture capital industry was six times that of the whole of the continent. The socioeconomic group we call the middle class had jumped from 33% to 50% of the population. Home ownership, as opposed to renting or having a public housing unit, had jumped from 53% to 71%. Ownership of shares by individuals, that's not owning them as part of some anonymously in some pension something, but actually directly owning shares, had gone from 7% of the population to 23%. And astonishingly, amongst trade unionists, from 6% to 29%. So in other words, amongst trade unionists, from being below the national average to being above. And finally, the percentage of the workforce belonging to a trade union had dropped from over 50% to under 20%. And the number of days lost to strikes every year had dropped from 30 million to 500,000. Pre-Thatcher, a sclerotic union-dominated economy was typified by surly service, poor products, and a craven business class. Post-Thatcher, even the institutionally left-leaning BBC has had to extend its coverage of the private business sector quite considerably, such as the interest in the market and in free market capitalism by employees, entrepreneurs, and shareholders. And both service and product quality have improved many times over. So, What are my 10 lessons, 10 strategic lessons from this story of Margaret Thatcher? I think first and foremost, she had a very strong political and moral compass. She could turn to a room full of men and say, I know this is right, you know this is right, the only question is how we're going to get from A to B. It wasn't the bossiness of the cartoons, you know, the cartoons showing her with the handbag, hitting ministers over the head with a handbag. It's quite funny, she often donates handbags to charities, charity auctions, and they go for a lot of money to own a handbag that Margaret Thatcher's. It's not so much the bossiness of the cartoons as much as total conviction. And if the chief has a very clear idea of where he or she is going, then the rest of the team better fall into line. A very early example, I don't know if you remember, in the spring of 1980, when the six Iranian terrorists stormed the Iranian embassy in central London and took 26 hostages. I don't know if you all remember that incident, where she sent in our crack special forces team, the SAS, and they went in at prime time, television time, I think on a Sunday afternoon, I seem to recall, and took out five of the six terrorists, and only one hostage died, and none of the police or SAS. So that sent a very strong signal. Secondly, she was able to cut through the guff, the nonsense, and get right to the heart of the matter and simplify it and communicate it. I mean, I know that President Reagan is known as the great communicator, but I would say that she gave him a good run for his money. I always think of her as Newt Gingrich together, because both of them are don't say at this moment in time, they say now. They're both very skilled at using simple, short Anglo-Saxon words. In fact, that reminds me, she once said to my friend Simon Jenkins, the newspaper commentator and author, and she said, Simon, laissez-faire, don't you go French on me. She's very clever, and I think people are being cruel when they said she never had an original idea. It might be true she never had an original idea, but she was able to synthesize, communicate better than anybody else. And that is undervalued. She did lead, soon after the 1987 general election, a newly elected Conservative MP called David Davis, who wrote a wonderful piece for Reason around about 1983 on private contracting out of management of Canadian hospitals and how that improved Canadian hospitals. He'd just been elected, and he was walking through the lobby, and he saw a friend who'd been elected in 1983 and who'd been promoted to a junior minister. And he called out, and the junior minister's hair was dishevelled, he was carrying a briefcase and a tray of papers. This is a true story. And David calls out, slow down. Rome wasn't built in a day. To which the minister shouted back over his shoulder as he disappeared down the corridor, yes, but Margaret wasn't the foreman on that job. That's true. Totally true story. I know both the characters, and they both told me that story. This next one isn't true, but this is sort of how she's perceived. And I'll talk a little about it. The story goes that in 1989, her cabinet and senior staff had a private dinner on the 10th anniversary of her becoming Prime Minister at the Café Royal. Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher sat at the head of the table with, say, 20 men in dark suits down each side. Waiter enters and goes, of course, to the Prime Minister. He says, sir, Prime Minister, would you like an appetizer? A prawn cocktail, please. Prime Minister, for your main course, a steak, please. Prime Minister, what kind of steak? Oh, I'll have a sirloin, please. Prime Minister, how do you like your steak? Oh, I'll have it rare, please. Prime Minister, some potatoes. Yes, sir, roasted, please. Prime Minister, what about the vegetables? Oh, they'll all have steak too. That was the perception. In reality, she was actually a very good listener, and much better the listener than usually given credit for. And she did listen mostly to cabinet ministers, and not all the best ideas came from her right-wing fellow right-wing conservatives, as in the case of the sale of public housing an idea that came very much from Peter Walker and was championed by Michael Heseltine, who are well to the left of her. And she was not always the hard-driving free market radical portrayed so often today. She worried about abolishing exchange controls. She wasn't sure at selling public housing at deep discounts. And some of the privatisations unnerved her a little bit. Fourth, she championed policies that went with the grain of human nature rather than against, such as selling public housing to sitting tenants and the offers of free shares in the or discounted shares to trade unionists in the great privatisations. Fifth, there was a lot of strategic thinking well ahead of time. For example, Ted Heath had lost the miners in the winter of 73-74 because the miners, there weren't enough coal supplies at the power stations. So as soon as she got in 79, her energy secretary, Nigel Lawson, began stockpiling coal. So when the miners went crazy after her re-election in 83 and took her on, they had a year or two's supply of coal already in place. She had some very good, smart people working for her. When I did politics in my first year at LSC, 71-72, Lord Donoghue was my politics tutor, and he referred to the Tory party as the stupid party. And there was some truth to that. But she changed that and surrounded herself with very good people. Seventh, there was a very strong sense of being in the last chance saloon. As she herself said, there can have been few in Britain who did not feel with mounting alarm that our society was sick, morally, socially, and economically. Eighth, we mustn't forget Ronald Reagan and their great friendship and partnership. In researching my book, I came across a quote in a primary source, not a secondary source, which I just found astounding. It's 1950, so she's 23 years old, and she's a warm-up speaker for a big Conservative Party rally in Kent, where I think the Foreign Secretary was due to attend. And she says, in 1950, we believe in the democratic way of life. If we serve the idea faithfully with tenacity of purpose, we have nothing to fear from Russian communism. It's astounding. I was just shocked when I found that. Preparation. Between 75, when she became leader, and 79, when she became prime minister, there was a lot of hard work done. A lot of hard preparatory work was done. And tenth, she didn't try to do it all at once. For example, a very good example would be the privatisations, which were rolled out over... Well, they're still rolling them out to this day. They've just announced the Mint... the canal system and the meteorological service are going to be... that was late, about 10 days ago in the Financial Times, I read that. And she didn't try to do it all at once. I mean, it was one or two big privatisations a year for 10 years, or 15, 17 years. On the trade union front, she didn't try to change them. We had employment acts going through Parliament in 80, 82, 84 and 88. So to conclude, to conclude this part, the lessons are: have a strong campus, simplify and communicate, lead but always listen, develop policies that go with the grain, think through your strategy ahead of time, build good teams, use circumstances, make good allies, prepare before you empower, and have patience. So, what would David Cameron have to do? Say David Cameron gets elected next spring. What would Dave, as he likes to be known, what would Dave have to do to match Margaret, to catch up with Margaret on the league table of past prime ministers? Well, just as I outlined nine things that she did a few moments ago, let me outline what Dave would have to do. Firstly, he'd have to deregulate and stop the tsunami of new regulation that is swamping us. Second, he'd have to renegotiate with the EU and just have a trading partnership and get our sovereignty back from the EU. Bring crime down, reform our health service, increase educational standards, reform welfare, simplify and reduce taxation, and balance the books. If Dave did that, then he'd be up there with Margaret. So how do we rate her? The leftist-leaning BBC rates her the 16th greatest British person ever. You know, there with Walter Raleigh and Francis Drake and Queen Elizabeth and all the great scientists and so on. Charles Moore, the prominent newspaper editor and commentator, with all due respect to Queen Elizabeth II, ranks her as the greatest living Englishwoman. And Francis Beckett, who is one of our leading historians, has done a... It just so happens that we had 20 prime ministers in the 20th century, and he's just done a big study and come up with a ranking. And I'll quickly take you through the 20 prime ministers from the bottom up, and then I'll take questions. 20th, Neville Chamberlain. Wouldn't disagree with that, would you? 19th, Sir Anthony Eden. 18th, John Major. 17th, Sir Alec Douglas Hume. 16th, Ramsay MacDonald. 15th, Andrew Bonar Law. 14th, Arthur Balfour. 13th, James Callaghan. 12th, Tony Blair. 11th, Harold Wilson. 10th, Stanley Baldwin. 9th, David Lloyd George. 8th, Herbert Asquith. 7th, Lord Salisbury. 6th, Sir Henry Campbell Bannerman. 5th, Harold Macmillan. 4th, Winston Churchill. 3rd, Edward Heath, the man who took us into Europe and lied to us so much. 2nd, Clement Attlee, the man who nationalised everything post-World War II. And 1st, Margaret Thatcher. Yeah.